summary of yesterday's lecture. So you know that starting on from Monday, it will be one of you doing the summary. So I think the first one is maybe Alfredo. Or, I don't know, but I will discuss that during the tutorial. But so yesterday we first finished on this constraint system. So we've seen that there are different kinds of constraints. So for primary, secondary, tertiary, so you know that the primary is obtained when you analyze the conjugate momenta map, okay? You see if it's invertible or not, then you get the primary, and then you want that this primary is does not involve stay a constraint with the time evolution. So sometimes it happens that you need to impose additional constraints. So these are the secondary end. And once you have all your constraints, you can look at if they are first class or second class. So first class means that if you look at the Poisson bracket between them, they all need to vanish weakly, okay, on the constraint surface. So this means that they can be proportional to the result can be proportional to some of the constraint. And this first class constraint are the one we are going to find in the 3D gravity theory, which are gauge symmetry. Okay, and they are going to generate gauge symmetry. And then the other one are what we call the second class. And at the end of the course, when we will mention the spin foam approach in 4D, we will see that one of the difficulties of the spin foam approach is that now we are dealing with second class constraint and we don't really know how to quantize them. Okay, so this is the part from the. And then we move to one different example of the example of the parametrized particle, and the idea was to look at totally constrained system, which is going to be what we are going to get when we are going to do the canonical analysis of GR, okay, in 3D. And so, what did you hear? It was a bit artificial because we introduced the parameter, the time t, as independent parameter. Okay, so we introduce this s as an additional parameter, and then when we look at the Hamiltonian analysis, canonical analysis, what we find is that the Hamiltonian is proportional to the constraint. And here, it's what we have in front of is a Lagrange multiplier. So now, of course, when you have here, the next step is to look at the flow generated by the Hamiltonian, meaning for the phase space variable. So you look at this equation and this equation, which are going to give you the time evolution in terms of this S parameter for your two phase space variable. And what you find here is that this is going to be a function, is going to be written in terms of N, the Lagrange multiplier. So this means that here the evolution is not unique, whereas you know that we started, you know that here we are just talking about a free particle. So you're expecting to go back to the usual physical interpretation. So are here, what are the kind of questions we can ask? Okay, because you see that here you can have evolution which are going to depend on this Lagrange multiplier, so it's not unique anymore, but it's something that we're going to get also in the case of gravity, where in gravity we cannot really come back to a simpler system like here where we can just come back to the usual free particle. So the kind of question we are going to ask is more what we call relational questions. And these kind of questions are going to be quite natural in the context of, for example, the universe. So what do I mean by relational questions? This means that, for example, here you could ask, what is the value of Q when T is equal to? Okay, so here you have two phase space variables. So you can ask, what is the value of one of them when the other takes this value, okay? You cannot ask what is the value of Q when S is equal to zero, because S is not a physical parameter. And in the case of the universe, this kind of question is quite, so when we consider the universe, this means that you're doing some cosmology. The universe is everything, okay? So the kind of question is, when you're going to construct a clock, is going to be a portion of the universe, in fact, what you're going to consider as your clock, okay? And so this means that your clock is going to evolve in time, because it's just in, it's going to be given by the evolution of this portion of the universe. So the type of question you will be able to ask is, what is some portion of the universe doing when the portion we use to define our clock, for example, measures the year 1983, okay? So this is a kind of relational question which are really natural in the case. And this, you can see that here in this context already, it's what you have to ask if you really want to have meaningful question and with interesting answer. Okay, so this was just a first point. So then I just wanted to, so here, yeah, let's now talk a bit about the number of degrees of freedom, because it's also a feature that we're going to find again in the gravity approach. So what is the number of degrees of freedom? So we know for this system that you want to go back to the free particle. So the phase space, the dimension of the phase space of your free particle is just 2, okay? Because you have the position and the associated momentum. So you're expecting 2. So what you're expecting here is 2. But now what is the dimension of our phase space here is 1, 2. It's 4, okay? Everyone agree? So we are starting from 4, and this is what we call the kinematical phase space, because phase has a dimension 4, because we haven't constrained it yet, okay? And so now how do you see why we are going back to 2 here? How many constraints do we have? Yeah, we have only 1 constraint. So how does it, do you know?
Can we get a secondary constraint?
No, there is no secondary constraint here. We have, the system is completely defined by this, but remember this is a gauge symmetry, okay? So this means that it's going to be -1 degree of freedom is going to be lost by implementing the constraint, okay? So then you get 3. So how do you get 2? But then you remember that we said that on the gauge orbit, all states are physically equivalent. So this means that now you need to pick up 1. So it's what we call, we are going to divide by the gauge orbit, meaning that instead of your curve now, you want just 1 point, okay? So it's an additional -1, okay? So this is really important, the way when you have gauge symmetry, when you do the counting of degrees of freedom, when you have 1 constraint, it's -2 degrees of freedom, and it's always valid for any gauge symmetry. Okay, so it's -1 by implementing C, and -1, or let's say dividing, but we're going to see what this means a bit more in detail. The gauge. And also one important point is that normally when you want to do the counting of degrees of freedom, really are supposed to have really done all these analyses, okay? Find all your primary, secondary, and then find what are the first class and then the second class. Because for the first class, it's going to be each first class constraint is going to remove 2 degrees of freedom, whereas 1 second class constraint is just going to remove 1 degree of freedom, okay? So you see that for the counting of degrees of freedom, normally you're supposed to do all this analysis, this one, and then look at which one are first class and second class. Okay, so what does it mean here? This means that we want 2 degrees of freedom, so we are expecting 2 independent, what we call Dirac variables, which are gauge invariant variables, or Dirac observables, okay? So here we want 2 Dirac variables. And by Dirac here, I mean gauge invariant. And we also call that what we call the observable. So if I'm calling f one of the Dirac variables, what I'm expecting from, what is the condition on f I want? So we want this, what is the property? We want them gauge invariant. So what does it mean? Yeah.
That it's vanishes this Poisson bucket with the constraint.
Yeah, okay. And again, since we are always in, so here it sees the constraints, right? Since we are always interested only on what is happening on the constraint surface, okay, here it can be a weakly zero, meaning that this can be also proportional to some constraint, okay, meaning it's vanishing. And these are very important objects, okay, because for the quantization of the theory, because this objects are not going to carry any gauge information. Otherwise, when you're going to do your gauge theory, your quantization, you're going to have some redundancy and some infinity and stuff like this. So these are really important for the quantization. So this is the definition of Dirac observable. We want that for any constraint. So how do we, I'm not going to give you too many details because I don't want to spend too much time on this parameterized particle, but it's quite useful to see how we can construct this physical observable. So I'm just going to give you the main line and tell you what is going to be, so in this case, we're going to do it quite easily and tell you what is going to be, make that it's going to be very difficult in the gravity case, okay? So first we need to select, the first step to select as many, gauge fixing condition as constraint. Okay, and then of course the tricky part is to see what is a good, what we call a good gauge fixing. Okay, so I'm not going to give you details here, but in this case we can just, of course we know that what makes that we have more degrees of freedom is that we have done, we have put the t as a dynamical variable. So here we just need to fix that. Okay, so this means that we are going to fix t to give a fixed value tau. So for some fixed parameter tau. Okay, so in this case, it's going to be easy to find. This one is going to be a good gauge fixing. And then the next step is, so given a phase space function, so F, we can define the associated physical observable so that I'm going to denote big F of course going to depend on the parameter tau here and its value here on a gauge orbit is going to be given by the value on that point S of the gauge orbit so S is our curvilinear parameter here of the gauge orbit so the gauge orbit can be is also parameterized by this curvilinear parameter but it's only one point on the gauge orbit on which the gauge fixing, so t here is also a function of s, I forgot here to write it here, so where our gauge fixing holds. Okay, so let's see what does it mean in our example here. So here, let's consider two phase space functions, the simplest one, so we have, let's consider q, And let's consider P, which is the momentum associated to Q. Okay, so let's consider the two phase space function, because we know that here we're expecting only two independent Dirac variables. Okay, and since we fixed the gauge for this one, we are going to use that to define this. So now we look at the flow generated by the constraint for each of the variable in the phase space. Okay. And in fact, it's exactly the same calculation as you have here, except that now here it was proportional to n, but you don't have the n anymore, okay? Because h is an nc. So you do exactly the same. You look also at the evolution along the gauge orbit for the associated momenta, okay? So it's the same kind of equation. And the solution gives you the gauge orbit generated by C. And so here, you compute. So this gives you an equation that you can solve. You get Q of S. And so you're going to get, as a solution, you get Q of S. And now the value of your observable associated to Q, so FQ, okay, at tau is going to be given by the value. So you evaluate this solution, value of Q at the point of the gauge orbit where T takes the value tau. Okay, which means where the gauge orbit holds, takes the value. Okay, so how does it work? Here, from this equation, you're going to get T of S, and you fix that to tau, okay, tau. So then you can also get tau as a function. It's going to give you the value of S, where the gauge fixing holds, and you use that to define the value of your observable here. So I'm not going to do that really explicitly. You can do it yourself. It's quite, in this case, everything works quite well. So any question? So then what do we recover? So I can give you anyway the result like this. You can, if you want to check, do yourself the calculation. So here it's Q of tau, where you get that it's Q plus well, this is the initial parameter. And you do the same with this one, and you just get that it's a constant. And this gives you the complete set of Dirac observable, and then you can check that now you recover the usual Poisson bracket, so that it's going to be 1. As you know, remember, we have this QP equal to 1 in the original phase space. And here you can also compute the H at the given, at the gauge fixing, and the Hamilton, the physical Hamilton, you recover the physical Hamiltonian, okay, with respect to the gauge fixing. So here you're going to recover, when you fix the gauge, and the gauge is a good one, but this one was easy to find, you recover the phase space of the original unparametrized particle, including the symplectic structure, and its Hamiltonian as a time evolution, okay? It's going to give you the time evolution parameter. So here you see that the physical time evolution can be recovered, but for that we found what we call perfect clock observable, which is in this case possible, but it's not always easy to find a globally valid gauge fixing. For example, not possible to find always a clock which is going to go would always go forward. Okay, in this case, this is possible, but for example, you could try here just to, instead of choosing to fix the gauge on the T, try to fix the gauge on the Q variable. And you will see that things are going to get really messy, okay? And that it's going to be very difficult to get a physical interpretation for that. And here, why is it working for the T variable is because our action here was linear, okay? The conjugated momenta appear linear in the constraint, okay? And in relativistic systems, so of course general relativity, but already for the simply relativistic particle, you will see that the constraints are going to be quadratic in all the momenta, and so you don't have this choice because here it was linear in the momentum associated to T. Okay, this is why this was a good clock, and so in fact it's going to be really difficult to. The fact that it's now quadratic is going to make things difficult to quantize, but also this is going to reflect that the time and space are now on the same footing, okay? Because here you can see that even looking at the Hamiltonian of this system, even with Q and T as independent variable, they do not appear on the same footing, whereas in relativistic system, you won't be able to make the difference, okay? The momenta are going to appear the same way. Okay, so this is what I wanted to say on this parameterized particle and to show you what are the steps, what we're supposed to do to go back to the physical interpretation when you have a totally constrained system. So any questions here? No? Okay, so now we're going to start again to talk about gravity finally. So we're going to come back to the first order action of 3D gravity and then do the canonical analysis, see what are the gauge symmetry of this first order action. And then as I told you, now an important point here is that we need to do all this analysis because we need to find, here we're going to find constraint, of course, but we need to find which one are first class to determine which one are going to generate gauge symmetry, and of course also to do the counting of decrease of freedom to see that we have all the constraint. It's always good to check when you're doing this kind of Hamiltonian analysis that you are not forgetting any constraint and the way you're interpreting the constraint as first class and second class is correct by doing a counting of degrees of freedom. Okay, so let's start. So I can clean this blackboard. Okay, so now the idea is we're going to start on the canonical of the 3D gravity first order action. Okay, so we are going to start with this action, so 1/2 of OL F mu, and then now I have this tensor density. Okay, so this is my action. Now what I want to do is look at this kind of slicing of my manifold where I consider a 2D surface time R. So this means that if this is manifold, I'm going to find a kind of equal time surface, but of course here time is not really physical equal time. But let's call this like this. And for this, I need also adapted coordinate. So mu, my space-time indices, I'm going to consider that the time is going to be, I'm going to call zero, and then A for the spatial part. So it's going to be A, B, C. Of the space-time indices at equal, on the equal time surface, okay? So now let's, oh yeah, okay. So here you remember the connection. This is a function of the spin connection. And the spin connection, I used to call it omega, but I'm going to change notation. Sorry, guys, about that. I'm going to rename omega into A. Okay, it's just because otherwise I'm going to always do the mistake because the majority of the literature is using the A in the canonical, at least in the canonical formalism, okay? Not in the spinorial, but in the, not in the covariant formalism, but in the canonical one. So I'm going to use that. So it's going to match and so now the idea to do the canonical analysis of this action is to isolate the time derivative to define momenta, okay? So here I'm going to isolate time derivative to define so you see, do you remember the definition of F? So F was defined as the derivative of the spin connection anti-symmetrized plus some other term, but so I can give you again the definition of the curvature tensor. So F mu nu was mu L plus epsilon AJK mu J and mu K. Okay, so of course, the time derivative are going to come from the term with a zero here. Okay, so if you look now at F, so I remember, I recall you that this is anti-symmetric, so you cannot have F zero zero, but you have F zero A. And so if you look at this, which is also equal to minus F A zero, then from this, you're going to get some derivative of the connection with respect to time, okay? So if now you rewrite your action, putting on the side this derivative with respect to time, what you get is, so you have the zero AJ, and here you have the, so I'm just rewriting this section with this term on the side. And how do I define epsilon AB? It's just epsilon 0 AB, OK? Well, I forgot about the time here. Plus, then you will have a term 0 J 1 half of F AB, OK? So in you have F 0 A, and then you have the F AB terms. Where here you don't have any time derivative, so I'm keeping like this. And then if you write explicitly what are these terms, of course you don't have only this one, so you're left with BJ. Where here this comes from this second term that I did integration by part, okay, to get here. Okay, so this, and then this, of course, is still time epsilon AB.
One question.
Yeah.
When you have the integration by parts, I'm not sure if I'm, but when you have the integration by parts, shouldn't you also have inside of the derivative the determinant that is in the epsilon? Because epsilon is not a constant, right?
No, epsilon here. There is no determinant here. The epsilon is just the. So why do you put this? You consider it as a density is because if you want to put all the indices down, then you will have a term proportional to the determinant of the metric coming here. But here, it's really just the totally anti-symmetric tensor, OK? So yeah, no, there is no, yeah, good question, OK. Here, if you remember, when we started from the Einstein-Hilbert action, you're right that there was this square root of determinant of G. But then this was reabsorbed in the definition of, yeah, so there is no more if you look at the calculation. Okay, so what are the canonical variables that we have here? So here we have one the time derivative is only on this one. So the canonical variable associated to A is going, so can you tell me what it is? Reading from this action. So you see that this is, it's equivalent to the Q dot. So the P associated to that is, yeah?
PJB epsilon
AB. Yeah, okay, so this is epsilon AB with a density. And this is what we're going to call the densitized triad, okay, so it's E. And if you're familiar with the Young-Mill theory, okay, this is connected to the electric field in electrodynamics or in the Young-Mill theory. And so this is the canonical variables. Okay, these are the canonical. Of our theory. And so this is K. Oh, maybe I should put. So, of course, in the action is with a J, but here I need to have different indices, otherwise, to write the Poisson bracket. So let's define KB. So this is a densitized. Triad. So you have the SU2 connection and the densitized triad here. And of course, this is going to depend on the indices. So here you get JK. Well, my indices are not really well. And then all the other Poisson brackets are going to vanish.
Why is that?
Sorry?
Why is that?
Why, so this comes from the, so this is, so you know that when you have an action written like this in this canonical approach, it's going to define the symplectic structure, okay? And so the symplectic structure associated to this action is just given by these two, and these are only the two dynamical variable. And in fact, we're going to see that this one, because there is no time derivative, and this one, there is no time derivative, are now going to be non-dynamical variable and are, in fact, going to play the role of Lagrange multiplier, okay? So here you have that. But here it's also only between this and other SU2 connection is like Q between Q, okay, is going to be 0, and PP is going to be 0. Here you have, it gives you the QP, okay? Variables. So here, all the other Poisson bracket, it's really analog to what you have in is 0. So the PP is 0, and Q bracket is also 0. And now we have that A0J, E0J, and AJ0, they are linear action in this variable, and there is no time derivative. No time derivative. And so these are what we call are going to be are just Lagrange multiplier. So now what are the equation of motion? So any questions here? What are the equation of motion? So you get two, in fact, what are going to be constrained, because there won't be any time derivative. So let's, here, if you remember what was the definition of the torsion, this is, in fact, some component of the torsion, special component of the torsion. And so now if you look at the equation of motion, you're going that you get two equations of motion. This is going to be 0, and this is also going to be 0. And since there is no time derivative in these two terms, of course, what you get are constraints. Okay? So you can see that here, that the equations of motion are going to be. So the first one is Fi, which is defined as 1/2 of and this has to be equal to 0, and this is this is the expression. I'm going to use it later. And you have a second constraint. So here, there is no, for both of them, there is no time derivative. So these are TABG, epsilon. Again, this has to be equal to 0, and explicitly this is given by, well, I don't need the epsilon AB anymore. So we can simplify. So this is obtained by the variation with respect to AJ0 and EJ0, and the second one by AJ0. Okay? So, yeah?
Just a small question. Yeah. I think I just understood what Monica said. I mean, this epsilon delta the third shouldn't the A be up, and because you said that you get the density when you change the indices. It should be up, right? The AB should be up, right?
Yeah, sorry, yeah, you're right. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, thank you. Okay, any other comment on? Yeah, you're right. Very good. Okay, so this is what we call the flatness constraint. And we're going to see why. And do you know how we call this one? From your, yeah.
The Gauss constraint.
Yeah, the Gauss constraint, and maybe you're already familiar with that from Young-Mills type theory. Okay, so these are our two constraints. So let's look, what is our kinematical Hilbert space here? So the kinematical Hilbert space is given by kinematical phase space, sorry. We are not at the quantum level yet. So kinematical phase space. So is described by which variable? What are the dimension? What is the dimension of this phase space? Okay, so the variable for the describing the kinematical phase space are this connection and the densitized triad. And how many do we have? We have 4 plus 4, okay? So the kinematical phase space is AE, and it's 4 here, so we have 8 degrees of freedom. But now we have constraint. So the constraint, we are going to define a constraint hypersurface. So maybe I should use. Okay, so here I'm going to give you and so here, it's only point on of the phase space described by the Gauss constraint is equal to zero and the flatness constraint is equal to zero. Okay, so here it's phase space. So you want the point in the phase space such as this is equal to zero, satisfying these two constraints. Okay, so what is the dimension of this constraint hypersurface? It is again 2 plus 2, so it's 4. But we are going to see, so now you cannot, you don't know that, but they are going to be first class, so generating first class constraint. And so here you have 2, 2, so the dimension is 4.
And in these phase field variables, they are defined at each point on the hypersurface, right?
Yeah.
But we don't count them two, let's say when you have two connections at different points on the hyperspace.
So repeat the question?
Yeah, so like, let's say you have two connections at different points on the hyperspace. Because of the diffeomorphisms, you don't count them as separate, right?
So you're talking about on the phase space description or the space-time description?
In terms of the...
So here's a picture that... it's a space time, okay? So I'm considering my manifold and then I'm doing this slicing, okay? But here I'm talking about phase space, so here's the A and the E variables. So, but you have one A and one E variable, so it's dependent on the space, okay, that are living on our hypersurface here.
And I was wondering, maybe in counting it, you probably might be counting, say, for example, in general, when you, in field theories, you talk about there being an infinite degree of freedom because of the fact that at each point.
Of course, it's times, yeah. So this is times infinity, yeah, because it attaches, yeah. Yeah, you're right. Then if you really want to do, yeah, in fact, you have an infinite number, but it's just that at a given point, yeah, we can. Yeah, good. Okay, so now we're. So do you see why this is a totally constrained system? So this is our action. So this action is this term, which is equivalent to the PQ dot term. And then you have this term written in terms of constraint. And you know that, so if we do just by log g to this pq dot, this action can be written like, is usually written like this, okay? So here this means that h is so there is a minus here. By analogy, we get and so this is what we're going to call our Hamiltonian. Well, this is our Hamiltonian. And you see that it's a sum of constraints. Okay? So it's a totally constrained system, and these functions are in fact arbitrary functions here, okay, and they are our Lagrange multiplier. So now the question is, the two questions we want to look at are, what are the symmetries generated by the constraint? So what is the interpretation of this constraint? And you know that constraints are going to generate a flow. So what is the flow on the constraint surface? And we want to know what kind of constraint do we have, okay? So are there first class? So here it's only primary. But do we have more constraints and are there first class? So we need to look at the what we call the constraint algebra, okay? Because we need to look at the Poisson bracket of the constraint between themselves to see if there are additional constraint or not. So then we're going to look at the flow generated by the constraint and the constraint algebra. Okay, so any questions here? So we want to look at the flow generated by this constraint. So, but here you see that what is different that for the parameterized particle or for the other example we have seen in the tutorial is that now you are in field theory, okay? You're talking about fields. So in order to calculate Poisson bracket here, it's better, everything is going to be much more well defined if we talk about smeared constraints. So have you already looked at that? You know what is a smeared constraint? So this means that, do you know? No, you never heard of that? Okay, so here I have two constraints, and instead of just looking, I'm going to look at G, which is going to depend on this parameter, phase space parameter, and I'm going to J. So these are going to be, and I'm going to do the same for the F. So why are we doing that? And in fact, we are going to see that since we want to quantize everything, we don't like when we are, we need to regularize. Otherwise, we are going to get many delta. Because the issue here is that, of course, maybe I under that. You see that all these variables here, when you look at them, at the Poisson bracket, there are some delta appearing. Okay, so of course, if you now look at the Poisson bracket between the constraint, since they are defined in terms of this variable, you are going to get many delta everywhere. Okay, and then when we are going to, we want to quantize things, we don't like this delta because we are going to get infinities. So that's why we need to introduce this smeared constraint. And of course, here it's going to be defined for all choices of lambda and n. So to say that g, j is going to vanish at any point x, okay, it's the same thing as to say that g lambda is going to vanish for any lambda here. So it's really equivalent. So here, this is, since we are talking about field now, it's better defined that constraints. And of course, this is defined, so this is two different. Important result defined for all so here we have H, which is as for the parameterized particle equal to zero because it's the sum of constraints, but it can still generate a flow. Okay, so we are going to look at this. So we want now to find the interpretation. Of the constraint, so we are going to look at the flow generated by first the Gauss constraint. So let's look first at the Gauss constraint. And I want to look at infinitesimal change in, so the phase space variable, so my phase space variable again are this densitized triad and A. So let's first look at the change associated to the Gauss constraint. So this means that I'm looking at the flow generated by the Gauss constraint on this phase space function. So I want to look at this. And here I'm going to consider the smeared Gauss constraint. Okay, so let's rewrite what I get. LBM. Of course, these are all functions of y, and then you integrate. Okay, So which part is going to be, so here I only have this, and I'm taking the Poisson bracket, sorry. So which part of this constraint is going to interact here? Yeah?
The second part.
Yeah, with only this A, okay? It's the only non-zero Poisson bracket I get. And so here you will see that the fact that I have this integration, now I won't get, this is going to get, I'm going to get rid of this delta. So here, if you just use this Poisson bracket here, what do you get? You just get that it's epsilon dmk is a minus am, because I change the order here, lambda k, which is now evaluated at x. So do you see, do you know if this is related to infinitesimal transformation? Do you have an idea of which transformation is that? Do you recognize or? Yeah. Yeah. So do you see right? So this is going to be a rotation for the internal indices, and I'm just going to give you the justification. So, and of course it's infinitesimal. So here, how do you see that? Of course, so here I'm talking about so let's see, if I have the cotriad, then the fact that it's densitized is not going to change anything. Under an internal rotation, we said that it was going to be modified, like, so this is a vector for the internal indices. Okay. And so if now I'm looking, so my rotation is going to be something like exponential of, then let's put a vector which is going to represent the axis and give you the angle, where the J here are the SO3 generators, okay? So if you, so it's in the, so it's 3x3 matrices. So here, what does it mean? This means that you know that you have three generators. So for the x direction, y, and z. So here, this scalar product is just that you have lambda x, the component x times gx, plus lambda y times gy. So here, you can look on Wikipedia, I don't know, to find the expression, explicit expression of this matrices, okay, it's 3x3 matrices, and then if you develop everything, then you get, you can show that if you go to the first order, so at the infinitesimal level, indeed R can be written as, so with R, it's a matrix, so the component is delta ij, plus you have epsilon, so this epsilon, so here, I just mean that it is small, so I can develop at the first order. And then you will get this epsilon ijk coming out. Lambda k. So I don't know if you can read. Maybe I can erase this here. So you get this lambda k. And so now if you replace in this expression at the first order, you can, of course, show that this gives you the infinitesimal transformation. Okay, for the variation. So here we just look at the variation. So yeah, this means this, you want to look at the mu k minus, so the prime, so this gives you the delta. And at the first order, you get exactly what we wrote here. Okay, so here, this, I'm going to finish here, but we can see that at least we expect the Gauss constraint is going to be related to internal rotation, okay? And I will give you, so on Monday, I will finish with the other variable, so the connection, and then we're going to see what is the interpretation of the flatness constraint, okay? As a symmetry. Okay, thanks, guys, if there is no question. See you at this afternoon for the tutorial.